Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio, covering Central California from Bakersfield to Fresno and beyond, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, when Henry T. Perea resigned his state assembly seat last year, it set off a chain reaction of events that could have Valley voters voting in the same race four times in the next 12 months. We'll talk to two of the candidates for the seat and hear their differing visions for the Valley. Plus, the tiny house trend is sweeping the nation. Fresno recently became the first city in the country to officially allow the houses as part of the city's new development code. Now the owners of one local business say they're cashing in. We'll find out why small is the new big. And we'll hear a preview of the new release by classical violinist Eric Gratz, a Fresno native who's now doing big things in the classical music world outside of the Valley. That's all coming up later in our show. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the general election. California is getting more diverse, but it's still older, whiter, and wealthier voters who turn out on Election Day. This year, we're partnering with KPCC, KQED, Capital Public Radio, and KPBS to explore what issues and candidates people are talking about, what's driving them to the polls, and what's keeping them away. As part of our California Counts election collaboration, KQED's Stephen Cuevas introduces some of the communities we'll be visiting.
First stop, the working class community of Watts, just south of downtown L.A.
Headed to work. I voted in the past, but voting doesn't mean nothing.
On a recent weekday, Samuel Price was waiting to catch a bus to work.
The political process to me is all a big game. To me, it's all corrupt. It's all about money.
It's not clear already, Price doesn't vote. Most precincts in the Watts area saw fewer than 22% of eligible voters show up to the polls in the 2014 general election. Hundreds of miles north, in Meadowview, predominantly black and Latino middle to lower income neighborhood of Sacramento, voter turnout hovers around 45%. Walk just a few blocks west to the community of Puckett Greenhaven, turnout is significantly better.
I vote every time.
Ellen Brahms says she's voted in every single election she could in the past 50 years.
It maybe doesn't seem like it makes a difference, but I always look back and think you plant a seed and you have to look at the long view.
Puckett Greenhaven is predominantly wealthy and white. 60% of the registered voters here turned out for the last general election.
We can't ignore the linkages or the parallels between poverty and wealth versus turnout.
California Secretary of State Alex Padilla says many of the state's unregistered and most disenfranchised voters live in communities like Meadowview and Watts.
Disproportionately communities of color, disproportionately younger people, and disproportionately working class families. You know, what are the reasons for that?
Maybe we can find out over dinner with the Medellin Huerta family in Lindsay, a small farm town about an hour southeast of Fresno. Like,
what's your opinion on voting?
Luis Medellin is trying to understand why his sister Amy doesn't vote.
Yeah, like I feel like sometimes my vote doesn't count, especially because right now the generation is in a point where like they don't care.
The thing is, Amy's brother Luis doesn't vote either. He can't. He was born in Mexico and is undocumented. But Amy, she was born here.
Amy is our family's voice because myself, I don't have legal status. My parents don't have a legal status. I don't want to say the word depend on her for our vote to count. But how would you feel if your family said, mija, go vote, you know, do it for us, you know?
There probably aren't many elected leaders who understand the value of each and every vote more than Ramona Villarreal Padilla, the mayor of Lindsay.
I think that I won maybe by 50 votes.
Padilla says she gets why some people feel disconnected. She felt that way too when she was a kid.
But my dad, if he left anything for any of us to know, he says, if you don't vote, then the government will take your voice away.
And there's a lot of muted voices out there. Nearly 7 million eligible yet unregistered voters alone in California, according to the Secretary of State's office.
Right now, we are on Orange Avenue. We are on Orange and 42nd.
Deborah Samuels is a volunteer with a local nonprofit that aims to boost voter turnout in San Diego. She works the neighborhood of City Heights. Less than 20% of registered voters here cast a ballot in the most recent elections. Nearly half of City Heights' roughly 75,000 people were born outside the U.S.
From Latinos, Vietnamese, and African, like from Ethiopia and South African also. When they just get naturalized, they are very excited because they can vote, they can ask for what they want, but when they see things not changing, that's what brings them down and they get disinterested.
We'll hear more from Deborah Samuels and the others in this story as we return to these communities throughout the year. In Los Angeles, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The June primary may seem like it's still a long ways off, and perhaps it is, depending on your perspective. But voters in the 31st Assembly District, which covers a big portion of Fresno County, won't have to wait until June to vote. Instead, they'll be filling out their ballots in just a few weeks, as the special election to fill the seat vacated by Henry T. Perea is just 2 months away, on Tuesday, April 5th. And they might want to get used to filling out those ballots, because if the scenario plays out just right, it's quite possible they'll be asked to cast ballots on this same seat 4 times between now and November 8th. So far, 4 candidates have announced their intentions to run. They include Democrats Joaquin Arambula and Ted Miller, as well as Republican Clint Olivier and declined to state candidate Daniel Tekunov. If there's a clear winner in the special election, that candidate will go to Sacramento to fill out the remainder of Perea's term. But if no one gets over 50% of the vote in April, the special election will continue with a runoff on June 7th. On that same ballot, the same candidates will also appear in the regularly scheduled primary, and again, the top two will advance to the general election in November. It's a scenario that's left the candidates scrambling, but it might be more than a political novelty act. Local political experts say it could give Republicans a chance of capturing a seat that's been held by Valley Democrats since Gerald Ford was in office. Here's political science expert Thomas Holyoke of Fresno State.
There's a tendency nationwide, and it really seems to emerge in Fresno, that Democrats tend to come out in stronger numbers in the general elections of presidential years. So if this contest had happened, you know, in November of 2016, that would have been to Arambula's benefit because Democrats have a greater tendency to turn out than anyway. Now we're going to have a special election, and it comes down more to who can really have the best voter turnout operation going. And that's something that has tended to benefit Republicans, and that which means it's going to benefit Olivier more than Arambula, although I think Arambula has some other strengths going into this.
One of those is name recognition. Joaquin Arambula's dad, Juan Arambula, held the very same seat from 2005 through 2010. But Olivier has his own name ID as well, first serving as a broadcast journalist for KMPH-TV and in his current role as a member of the Fresno City Council. So just who are the candidates and what would they do? Last month, I sat down with both Olivier and Arambula to get their thoughts on the issues, and we hear from them on our show today. Next week, we'll hear from the other two candidates. Right now, though, here's some highlights from my interview with Clint Olivier. You have potentially 3 elections in the next 11 months.
Yes.
You're a pretty busy guy right now.
Yeah. You know, things are going 100 miles an hour right now. It's everything. It's everything from fundraising to, you know, working on buying our signs to getting the right people in place. And so it is a mad dash, but every campaign is. And so it's been a lot of fun so far.
Were you surprised when Henry decided to leave office early?
Absolutely. I think that I was at City Hall on my way out of the building to a meeting, and of course somebody knew and texted me, you know, hey, in the next 2 hours Henry's going to announce his resignation, and I was absolutely stunned because I knew that it changed the entire dynamic of this race and really for the better.
There's some people out there who say this gives you a big advantage because Republicans fare better in a non-general election format. What do you think about that?
I think they're absolutely right. I mean, you have only to look a few years ago with Senator Andy Vidak, who was able to capture his seat in a special election. And so there is precedent for it. And you know, a lot of folks say, Clint, the 31st Assembly is a Democrat seat. Why would you run for a Democrat seat? When in fact, the opposite is true. Sure, there have been Democrats in the seat for a long time. But going back to Vidak, this AD 31 is actually represented by Senator Vidak, Senator Canella, Congressman Valadao, three Republicans. And so to me, the Democrat is the anomaly. And it's a Republican area because these people, my neighbors and my friends, vote the candidate, not the party. So I'm very hopeful.
You're also introducing yourself to a whole new group of voters. Certainly people in Fresno Metro are familiar with you through your time on the city council, also your time as a broadcast journalist. But going out to Mendota or Firebaugh, they face challenges that may be similar in some ways but also might be different than some of your problems your constituents face in the middle of the city.
That's true. But you talk about my days as a broadcast journalist. I covered Mendota. I covered the drought in the mid-2000s. I covered the water wars. I covered the birth of the Tea Party, which sprung up in our area really around the lack of water and the water wars. I've been to the shanty towns in our community and out by Mendota. I have a very good perspective of what's going on in our outlying communities. I have good relationships with people who live there and our food producers. So, yeah, I'm an inner city Fresno guy, but I'm a valley guy, and I've been on the ground for many years. And so, I don't think I could run for this seat and sound intelligent and articulate if I were totally new to this area and to this process.
You talked to some of your colleagues on the Fresno City Council, not about you, but just in general, the experience of being on the council, being in elective office is really an eye-opener for a lot of them. How have you changed this personally, your time being a broadcast journalist, now seeing how government works from the inside?
I think the Fresno City Council in many ways is a war zone. We're a one media market community, and it's not like LA where you can run for assembly from Huntington Beach or Redondo Beach and call a press conference to have people come and cover you and no one show up. I mean, here in the city of Fresno, being a one media market community, you can call a press conference about a city of Fresno related issue and everyone shows up. We've got NPR, we've got the affiliates, the newspaper and talk radio all show up. You're in the spotlight. And so to answer your question, being on the Fresno City Council it hasn't mellowed me because I'm still a passionate fighter for neighborhoods and for people, but it has taught me to be more pragmatic, to see things in a long-term strategy. When you're in media, like what we're doing now, you're going to assemble these raw materials, your interview, and this goes out over the air. And as soon as it goes out over the air, I mean, now we have the internet, but as soon as it goes out over the air, it's consumed, it's done. And that's what I was used to professionally in my career. You do a news story, it's done. I mean, you follow the same story for a period of time, but once it goes out over the air, it's gone into the ether. In politics, you have to see things long term. Someone can vote against you on the city council, make you very, very angry, but you're going to need that person a little bit further down the road. So it's prepared me for a life in Sacramento advocating for this area because with the new 12-year term limits, relationships are key. People aren't just going up there and saying, shoot, I got to get done as much as I possibly can because I only have 4 more years. Now you've got Republicans, you know, maybe chairing a committee. You've got Republicans at night going to Democrat events because people are building relationships. That's what I learned here in the city of Fresno.
What are your thoughts on the issue of fiscal management in Sacramento? Governor Brown released his budget. He's trying to sound a word of caution. Brown is saying we have to be ready for the next recession, which could be right around the corner. Yet there's a temptation, and this is a similar thing to, I imagine, what you face at City Hall and what you'll be facing later this year at City Hall. As revenues increase, there's a desire to spend that money because it's hard to argue against a lot of these things that are services.
This sounds to me like deja vu all over again. And that's because Governor Brown is to the legislature what Mayor Ashley Swearengen is to the city council. One of the big debates we've had on the Fresno City Council is the reserve fund. How much do we put in reserves? It's important to put money into reserves at the state municipal level for a rainy day. But it's also important to put money in reserves, at least in Fresno, because it improves our credit rating. So if we ever have a large project, we have to go out and get a loan for it. A better credit rating means a better interest rate, which means savings to the taxpayer. It's also important to have it because, let's face it, economic recovery never goes on forever. So we're going to see a recession or some kind of stymied growth here pretty soon. And so if there's a rainy day fund, I mean, the answer is obvious that there's a backstop. So the debate on the city council oftentimes is, well, we need this and we need that. And those things are needed. Tree trimming and potholes are needed. But money needs to be saved. Same thing in the state. I think the governor wants to up the rainy day fund, the reserves, to $8 billion. That's fantastic. But we're talking about a state general fund in this budget. It's $122 billion. And so $8 billion, that's a drop in the bucket. I'm thankful that Governor Brown resurfaced when he did. I think that he was the right guy at the right time to get California out of the Great Recession, an awful economic time. And so while I have beef with Governor Brown on a number of other issues, I think that I absolutely support what he's trying to do when he wants to increase the reserves. And I would be a voice for that kind of fiscal responsibility in Sacramento.
Speaking of beefs with Governor Brown, high-speed rail has to be one of them. What do you do with that?
Well, you quit building it is one of the things you could do. No.
Some people would say that's short-sighted.
You know, here's my take on high-speed rail. I have grave concerns about this project and what it could mean for the state. So does our progressive Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and other Democrats. That being said, you ask me how I've changed since I've been on city council. I think that when I first came in, I was more brash, maybe a little pig-headed. But I have learned that your constituents demand really one thing, and your constituents demand that you have a seat at the table to represent their interests. So high-speed rail is one of these learning points in my life. There was a time last year where they did the little rail. Instead of doing a ribbon cutting, everybody got a Sharpie and signed a stretch of rail. And so I went down to this rally that they had in downtown Fresno, and I was not on the guest list. I'm an elected official. I would say I'm a fairly prominent member of the Fresno City Council. People let me into things, and I thought I would just go in and observe, not heckle or make a spectacle of myself, but just to kind of, you know, see the governor and the mayor and the whole thing take place with a journalist's curiosity. And I went over there, and I wasn't on the guest list, and they would not let me in. The folks from the authority had instructions, don't let anybody in who's not on the guest list. And I watched for a couple of minutes before going on my way. I watched through the fence what was going on. And it was a learning experience for me, because while I still oppose the project and I still have grave concerns about the project, as the assembly member from District 31, the train goes through my district. My constituents are demanding that I have a seat at the table as we hash this out and move forward with this, whether the project goes or it stops, whether the project is blowing money or whether the project is fiscally responsible. If I'm going to be an effective watchdog and if I'm going to be an effective advocate, I have to be at the table. And that's the direction that I have learned. I had an awakening, and that's the direction that I'm going in. By no means do I sanction what they're doing. I do not like the project because it's risky and I'm concerned. But I absolutely need to be pragmatic and temper my feelings with a good dose of reality, which is I have to serve my constituents and I want to have a seat at that table as we move forward.
Fresno City Council member Clint Olivier is a candidate for the vacant seat in the 31st Assembly District. Clint, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and hear from one of Clint's opponents, Joaquin Arambula. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition.
And All Things Considered story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
Valley Public Radio is about to begin another season of Young Artist Spotlight. Once a week during February and March, young musicians from around the valley, north and south. I'm George Mason. We begin this season with cello co-principal chairs of the Advanced Youth Philharmonic Orchestra of Fresno. Live, Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Listening to Valley Edition. There's four candidates running for the seat that came open when Assemblymember Henry T. Perea resigned last year to take a job working for the pharmaceutical industry. A few moments ago, we heard from Clint Olivier. Now we hear from Dr. Joaquin Arambula, whose most recent job found him in the emergency room at a hospital in Selma. The Arambula name is no stranger to Valley politics. In fact, his dad, Juan, used to hold this very seat. But politics wasn't always the goal for young Joaquin. Here's some highlights from our recent conversation. Going from emergency room doctor to politician, that's not a common career path, at least if you look at those who are already in Sacramento. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we need more compassionate, articulate, intelligent people to get involved in politics. And I think it's a shame that more physicians aren't involved in advocacy. And I hope to change that. I think we have an important piece to add to the puzzle. If we truly want to fix healthcare, if we're interested in lowering overall costs, physicians need to be part of the solution. I'm a problem solver by trade. That's what I do. People come to me when they're sick and dying, and I do the best I can to patch them up and help them out. But I realized the problems of my emergency department were not ending as soon as they left my department, and that their struggles before they came to the emergency room were the same struggles they had when they left, that we are faced with an epic drought. We do not have enough jobs and quality jobs. Unemployment is too high. And I look at our educational system, which is supposed to give everyone an opportunity to succeed. And frankly, I was not convinced that the same opportunities that I was given, the same opportunities that my father were given, are the opportunities that our kids have today. And I believe, you know, I was told at an early age that if you don't like the government you have, go do something about it. And it was never my dream as a young kid to get involved in politics. My dream was to become a doctor. I achieved my dream. But I would like to change the way that we see our government.
What brought you to the career of medicine?
So I always I went to a math and science magnet school. I graduated from medicine 20 years ago. I went to school on the wrong side of the tracks. I started here in Fresno at Heaton, went to Manchester Gate, Computech, Edison. I liked our public schools. I was always drawn towards math and science. I like answers. I like hard truths. I'm a scientist by trade, and I enjoy that part of my mind. I'm very left brain. And I always knew I wanted to go into healthcare. And I like working in an emergency room because I don't have to look in your wallet or your passport. I take care of everybody, the human beings who are in front of me and asking for help. I enjoy taking care and being a servant. I serve my community now. I see myself as an advocate for my patients and really enjoy being a physician. It allows me to care. I'm so glad to be able to return and have a profession that I enjoy.
Who do you take after more, your mom or your dad?
Truth be told, more like my mom. So my father is the smart, charismatic, compassionate public servant, but my mom has a tenacity to her. She has a fight and a fire in her belly. And I will tell you, I am a bit of a travieso. In Spanish, that word means troublemaker. I enjoy being able to be an advocate for the people. And I really want to stand up. I think for too long here in the Valley, we have not got our just due. And I would like to be able to go to Sacramento and stand up and say that the Valley needs strong leaders. We need people who are going to stand up for us.
Has your dad given you any advice on politics that you'd care to share, perhaps?
I'd like to share that the first 6 months he told me not to do it. He quite honestly told me that these are your wage earning years. These are your years to put away money for your kids. I have three young daughters. I have a 4-year-old, Aviana, a 3-year-old, Scarlett, and a 5-month-old, Kennedy. And he said, these are your years to put away money so that when they want to go to school and achieve their dreams, that they have the finances to do it. And I heard him and I was trying to listen. He's very protective. But I realized something. I had to stand up. Now was the time. Last year, California added 3 million people to health care. They didn't add one more doctor to take care of them in the state of California. Those of us who are practicing medicine, who are on the front lines, are asking for resources. We're asking for help. I'd like to bring a medical school back to the Valley because we are understaffed as it is. We're the fastest growing part of the state, and we need to start planning for tomorrow, not dealing with the crises of today. Too often I see our politicians dealing with bumper sticker bills and not dealing with larger systemic issues. Our healthcare expenditures are too much. We spend too much money on healthcare. We're subsidizing inefficiency, and I would like to be able to help improve how we spend money on healthcare because I believe we can increase access to everybody, lower overall healthcare expenditures, which would allow businesses to then create jobs because healthcare premiums are lower. That's my vision and that's what I'd like to work for.
How do you do that?
I think you look at other best practices. As a scientist, I think other people have already created the wheel. We don't need to reinvent it. Let's evaluate how they're doing it. So let's look at the other countries that are roughly the size of us. I mean, California, we're the 8th largest economy in the world. We have 39 million people. To me, we are a large nation. And so how we start to see ourselves as a large nation, compare ourselves to those large nations, and then implement some of their policies and best practices in our healthcare delivery model is what I would like to do.
Is that a single payer model that you'd be looking at or Medicare for all?
I do like and I'm encouraged by the Medicare for all model. I don't come up with any of the answers. You know, I quite honestly in my profession was taught that you're supposed to ask the right questions. And so the questions that I want to ask are, why isn't healthcare working for us? Why aren't we having better metrics? Why can't we get more for our dollars? And I want to keep pushing until we get to an answer that everyone can live with and be comfortable with.
How important is it that this whole issue of Medi-Cal reimbursement, you know, you talk to physicians and they say this is, you know, I don't want to say the word nightmare, but it's a really bad situation. We can give coverage to people, but we need to be able to give them care. How big of an issue is that from your perspective as a physician, and then how do you pay for that?
Great question. So first off, I think Medi-Cal being as low as it is, we're in the bottom decile of the United States, tremendously affects access. You've seen lawsuits in Los Angeles where they've claimed that because of Medi-Cal reimbursement, you're disproportionately affecting Latinos and African Americans and that it's an equity issue. I don't go quite that far, but I believe that we need to increase Medi-Cal reimbursements to increase access to care. I believe that's how you lower overall healthcare expenditures. My logic is pretty simple. It costs $1 to prevent a disease. It costs $17 to treat a disease. What we're doing now is treatment. We're treating a lot of diseases. We're not preventing it. So we have to find a way to focus on prevention, focusing on giving everyone the care that they deserve. I believe healthcare is a human right. I believe everyone who lives in our communities deserves healthcare, and that by doing such, we'll actually lower healthcare costs overall.
There's kind of an interesting parallel. If you're successful in your bid to win this seat, you would be replacing Henry T. Perea, mm-hmm. who himself was the son of a politician, grew up with his mm-hmm. dad in office. He chose to go into politics right away, though. You chose a different route. What was that like growing up in your dad's shadow, as you said?
You know, as a young kid, I'm sure each and every one of us wants our father at every one of our own events. And, you know, selfishly, I would have loved to have had him at everything, but he was married to his constituency. He was married to this valley, and he cared deeply for this valley. As you start to mature in your own life, you start to appreciate what your parents do for you, how they model and mentor for you. And frankly, it's not what they say, it's what they do. My father loved this valley, and he served this valley for a quarter century. And each one of us kids has gone into a service profession. I'm a physician. My sister's a nurse. Both my brothers are teachers. You know, we care about this valley. We live here in the Central Valley. To me, it's really important that you show your kids what you want them to do. As I started having my own kids, it became apparent to me that I needed to start doing more. I needed to start championing so that they would see what I saw growing up. And hopefully they'll want to stay here in the valley that I love.
A lot of political experts, armchair quarterbacks, if you prefer, say that the fact that this is a special election gives your opponent a little bit of an advantage mm-hmm. in April. I asked your opponent that, and he said, yeah, he thinks it does as well. What do you think about that? This is a seat that's been held by Democrats. You had Rick Lehman, Bruce Bronson, Cruz Bustamante, Sarah Reyes, your dad, Henry. Democrats going back as far as we can remember.
You know, the joy of democracy is it comes down to a vote. And I'm excited that on April 5th, the voters of this valley will be able to select a winner. I'm confident that if we get our message out and that I'm able to tell them that I'm a son of the valley, that I am from here, I was born and raised here, I understand the problems of our valley, and I'd like to go represent and be a public servant, that the people of this valley will be able to see through the fog, if you will, and see where the quality candidates lie. And so I'm confident that on April 5th, we'll get, we'll be going in the right direction.
Henry positioned himself as a moderate. Your dad left the party and caucused with them. This is sort of a different area politically than the Bay Area, than L.A. How do you characterize yourself? Do you find yourself fitting into any particular camp? Who is Joaquin Arambula? Is he his father's son, or is he Henry's son, or is he someone different?
I tend not to like Arambula 2.0, Perea 3.0, those types of comparisons. I am an independent person. I enjoy reading the bills. I will read each and every one of them. I was disturbed, when my father was up in Sacramento, that he was fighting for a dam a decade ago. And he saw and knew that we come from an agricultural area and that we need more storage now. And we should have listened a decade ago. And because he was willing to stand up for what he believed, he went independent. I am going to be an independent-minded person who will always put the valley over partisan politics. For too long, in my opinion, our government has become polarized, and we need to remember that there's a sensible middle, that those of us who are sitting right in the middle can actually get things accomplished. And that's what I'm hopeful for and encouraged to believe, that in Sacramento we can do that.
Do you miss the ER?
I do. The part I miss the most is I miss caring. It's a very rewarding profession to be able to provide care to people, to give them whatever care you can. Oftentimes in our healthcare system, which is broken, people don't know where to turn. They don't know where to go, but they can always come see me. And I was always happy to see them. I was always willing to take care of them. But I can't see my people alone. I can't take care of them alone. And I had to go seek reinforcements. That's why I'm fighting to bring a medical school back to the valley.
Joaquin Arambula is a candidate for the 31st Assembly District race that goes to voters on April 5th. Thanks for taking the time today, Joaquin.
Thanks, Joe, for inviting me.
Small could be the new big, at least when it comes to houses. The so-called tiny house movement has taken off in the last year with numerous shows and even a popular Netflix documentary about living in homes of just a few hundred square feet. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports for one local company, tiny homes are huge business.
At a time when many potential homeowners are going big, a small but growing number of people are downsizing into homes that are smaller than your average garage. That's where Nick Mosley and his father, Pat, come in.
I mean, everything we build is under 350 square feet. So you figure as an entire house. So, yeah, very tiny.
In a cramped warehouse in central Fresno, the Mosleys and two other workers build custom ordered tiny houses from the ground, or more appropriately, wheels up. Nick offers three different size trailers, but all the houses are small, less than 24 feet in length, and contain everything you would expect from a normal home, all condensed into essentially one room.
It's basically one bedroom with a full house inside of it.
Nick heard about tiny houses last year. After attending a seminar, he and his dad decided to convert their kitchen and bath remodeling company into a fully dedicated tiny house construction company. And business, according to Nick, is booming.
We just expanded an extra 2,000 square feet so we could build two at once. The traffic just in the last week, I mean, it's been hard to work because of how many people have been coming in.
The recent announcement of Fresno being one of the first cities in the country to officially allow tiny houses has driven attention even higher. Nick says he never thought Fresno would be interested in tiny houses, but because of how the houses are constructed, and since they're on wheels, they can be shipped anywhere in the country.
For most of our houses, you don't have to have a special license to pull it. You know, you can hook a 3/4-ton truck and pull it to New York if you wanted to.
Nick's houses are highly customized, extremely polished, and can cost more than $70,000. But kits are available on the internet that cost only a few thousand dollars if you want to try and build one yourself. For all the publicity the tiny houses are pulling in, they remain a minuscule portion of the housing market. It's hard to get an exact count, since most municipalities do not permit the houses, so people build them in secret. The homes are restricted because tiny houses are on wheels and most building codes require a permanent foundation. There is, however, a tiny house website run by fans that attempts to track every tiny home in the country. It shows just a few in the valley, but that's hardly comprehensive. And Americans overall appear to be continuing to prefer ever larger and larger homes. The average size of a new home in the U.S. jumped from 2,600 square feet in 2014 to over 2,700 square feet last year, according to industry research. And there are plenty of news stories interviewing people who tried a tiny house, only to move out after a short time. Russell Jensen has lived in his tiny house in Selma for over a year.
But for me, it's my own space. It's quiet. It's really comfortable. It makes my life really simple.
Jensen bought his tiny home, which is a converted semi-trailer, from another family for $10,000. It's currently parked in his sister's backyard. He says it's perfect in his current situation. He's single with no kids, and it forced him to downsize his life. That is what many people talk about when they consider a tiny house. It's less about the actual house and more about how it makes them feel. But he can see how it would have drawbacks for a bigger family.
It's definitely not a solution for everybody, but I think the concept is a great eye-opener for everybody in that I really have discovered that the amount of stuff that I think most people have, most of it isn't adding to their happiness level.
And that's where the real question of the longevity of the tiny house movement comes into focus. Is this a fad or a real long-term solution for people turned off by renting or the cost of living in a larger house? Pat Mosley, the tiny house builder, says he's confident these homes aren't going away anytime soon.
With the water shortage and the housing costs going up, I think this is going to be a trend that you're going to see in the future. So I think it's going to be around for at least another 20 years.
And while tiny houses might not be for everyone, Mosley thinks that enough people will be interested for them to keep growing. In fact, he says he's already in the process of hiring more staff to meet the recent increase in demand. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Public Radio. There's a new CD that's out this week that's sure to capture the interest of classical music lovers, especially those from the San Joaquin Valley. That's because it's the debut recording of 24-year-old violinist Eric Grotz, who is today the concertmaster of the San Antonio Symphony. A decade ago, however, he was here in Fresno performing with local ensembles, including the youth orchestras of Fresno. He joins us now on Valley Public Radio to talk about this new recording and his career. Eric, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It has to be very exciting for you to release this album, a collection of duets, piano and violin. How long has this been in the works?
The idea, I mean, the whole thing was conceptualized quite a while ago. I knew that I wanted to record these works, and about a year ago, I finally narrowed it down to actually fit on a CD. And we recorded back in September in Cleveland at my alma mater, Cleveland Institute of Music. And we've been working on it ever since. Obviously, there's a lot more than just walking in recording. There's mixing and so on and so forth. And also, I'm wearing many hats in this scenario because I started a label. It's Eric Grotz is the label. Not too hard to remember. And the idea behind it is to help me have a way to get works out to people that I like to play and things that I've been working on for a long time and performing. Some of these pieces I've been playing for over a decade, but also it's, I guess you could almost call it a philanthropic effort because I have interest in helping support other young artists in doing the same thing as well. So I have a lot of plans for it, but this is the first one here.
It's a collection of chamber music, violin and piano. How did you decide on that? And tell me about your pianist.
Part of the album is solo and part of it is with piano. And so the solo portion is the real extreme virtuosity portion of it. We have the Isai Sonata and Nathan Milstein's Paganiniana, which is one of the hardest pieces in the repertoire. The rest are very intimate works, transcriptions, a movement of a sonata that was a collaborative effort of Brahms, Schumann, and Dietrich called the FAE Sonata, which means Frei aber einsamer, and it's just a motto that they had back in the day. And I called my friend Untek, Kim, who I've known for a long time. We met in Aspen almost 10 years ago now, and we decided to have a go at this project. And fortunately, we were able to play a lot of these works right before we recorded them. We were in Italy at a festival, a chamber music festival there, and got to perform the works and kind of get, you know, a couple runs under our belt. The recording process is very different from live performance, but it was extremely helpful to have this time together. And he's a really great guy and a virtuoso in his own right.
I want to take this opportunity now to play a selection from this new CD. Again, Eric Grotz, violinist, joins us today on Valley Public Radio. We want to talk about his connections to the Valley in a little bit. But before that, tell me about the Schumann piece.
Yes, so the Schumann is an intermezzo movement from a collaborative effort by Brahms and Dietrich and Schumann, and it's this sonata they wrote together, and it stands for Frei aber einsamer, and it means free but alone. And it's just sort of this motto, this very artistically driven motto that they shared together. And so this is just a little intermezzo movement, just a couple of minutes from the sonata. Thank you.
Violinist Eric Gratz on Valley Public Radio today from his new CD, a self-titled debut album. The violinist is the concertmaster of the San Antonio Symphony. He's held that title for 3 years now. About 10 years ago, he was performing here in Fresno and the San Joaquin Valley as he grew up here in Central California. Eric, your career has really taken off since you left Central California. Tell us about how you wound up with the job in San Antonio.
Well, I took a lot of inspiration from my old teacher in Cleveland, William Prusel, who's the concertmaster of the Cleveland Orchestra. And I saw that he gets to do a great number of things, teach chamber music, play solo, basically whatever you want. As a concertmaster, you have extreme versatility. And for someone who's constantly seeking new inspiration, motivation, the concertmaster job seemed like a good fit for me. Now, it wasn't just something that I automatically decided that I was going to do. Of course, I had to go through the audition process. And so the San Antonio Symphony had a vacancy for a number of years. They held a number of auditions before this one with no successful winner. And fortunately, I came in on the right day and was playing really well, and things just kind of fell into place for me. And it's been a wonderful match.
I did an interview a few days ago with Noah Bendix Bogley, who's the concertmaster of the Berlin Philharmonic, or one of the concertmasters. We were talking about what it takes to be a concertmaster and how one learns that craft. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, because it's a different skill set than just being a solo artist. How does one learn how to do what a concertmaster needs to do?
Well, as the saying goes, there's no substitute for experience. And I think it's especially true in this case. I did come sort of equipped coming in. I had some experience playing guest concertmaster for a number of orchestras back in the Midwest and for summer festivals and various things. But to really develop a sound with the strings over the course of hundreds of concerts kind of takes a different approach. One aspect of it that's very important is actually making sure that everybody's happy. So, you know, you need to let people know that you are after the same thing as everybody else, but at the same time, you need to demonstrate that you are a leader and that you are setting an example at all times. And you are really just the link between the conductor and the orchestra. The conductor doesn't make any sound, and so you're kind of the first draft of translating what any conductor will want from the orchestra, from the musicians.
Speaking of exceptional instrumentalists, you studied with Claudia Schuh, who is, of course, a great viola artist with the Fresno Philharmonic. Tell me about the impact that she had on your career.
Claudia is an incredible musician and person, and I was extremely fortunate to have the opportunity to work with her. Also at a very early age. I started studying with her at age 9, and before that I was with her sister, Cynthia Stewart, which is also, she's also a terrific player and teacher. And Claudia, you know, she helped inspire me to realize that this is something I could do for a living. And she actually made the push for me to move to Cleveland and to become a small fish in a really big pond again. to really kind of give me the reality of, you know, there are a lot of great players out there, and you're going to need to work hard, and you're going to be in an environment that's going to help nurture that. And so my time with her was incredible, and also I'm grateful for her to give me the push. She kind of kicked me out of the studio at the end and said, I'm not teaching you anymore. You need to go somewhere else. It's time for the next step. So I'm grateful for that.
Do you still maintain connections here in the Valley?
I do, yes. With a number of people. Obviously, I maintain connections with my parents, who started Youth Orchestras of Fresno a long time ago. But it's a whole musical family, my old teachers, and a lot of musicians that have gone through Youth Orchestras of Fresno and freelanced in the Valley. And there are a lot of amazing, amazing people there that I appreciate immensely. And actually, recently I played chamber music with Stephanie Sanambrogio, the concertmaster of the Philharmonic. She invited me to a festival here, Cactus Pear Festival, and just got to know her for the first time this past summer, and she's a wonderful, wonderful violinist and a new friend that I really appreciate.
So what's next for you? You have the CD that's come out, still working in San Antonio. What else is on your calendar and on your horizons? What are the things you'd like to do in the relatively near future?
Well, some things that are coming up. I'll be playing at the Mainly Mozart Festival in San Diego this summer, which is an amazing opportunity. It'll be my first time, and it's basically an orchestra of concertmasters and principal players from around the world. It's really one of the great, great orchestras, and I'll be thrilled to be a part of that. I'm also very happy to go back to Italy in the summer. My friend has a festival called Incontri Musicali in Spoleto. It's a wonderful, wonderful town, small town in Italy, and we go there and play chamber music for 3 weeks. I also have some stuff in the works for chamber music in Seoul, Korea, coming up, and just a number of exciting projects. As far as what I'm sort of working on, I guess, is kind of figuring out the follow-up here for this album just coming out. But it's also kind of time to, you know, look forward and see what I want to do next. I have some ideas about commissions. I have a great interest in new music, so we'll see if we can work some of that into the mix. But some exciting things happening.
Violinist Eric Grotz grew up here in the San Joaquin Valley. He is now the concertmaster of the San Antonio Symphony Orchestra, and he has a new CD out, a self-titled collection. The CD is available on iTunes and wherever fine recordings are sold. Eric Grotz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. When you're online, be sure to visit our website, kvpr.org. You can subscribe to our Valley Edition podcast and find audio archives of this program and past stories that our local reporters have produced. And congratulations in order for our reporters Ezra David Romero and Jeffrey Hess. Last month, they walked away with two prestigious Golden Mike Awards from the Southern California Radio Television News Association, an award for best feature reporting for our series on the drought, and a story about education reforms at Lindsay High School that won for best news reporting in Division B. Congratulations to Ezra, Jeffrey, and the entire news team. For the rest of Valley Edition staff, including audio engineer Marv Allen and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. Catch us again next week on Valley Edition here at Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.